Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
Right now on Last Call, throwing in the electric towel, one of Detroit's big three, stunning the auto world. Tech's next rally, a leading analyst out with a big call you want to hear. Big city money grab, how a high-stakes showdown in New York could soon be coming to a city near you. Another pandemic on the way, a scary story you have to hear about. And blacked out, solar eclipse is coming. Wait to hear what it's doing to some home rental rates. You'd be surprised. All that and more over the hour. So as always, belly up or buckle up. Last call is up right now. Hi, everybody. Good evening here. Good afternoon out west. I am Brian Sullivan. All that and more coming up across the hour. But first up on Last Call, a stock market that is getting more worried by the day. Today, stocks down, look at that, across the board. In some cases, like the Dow, having its worst day of the year. The Dow down 1.35% or more than 500 points at one point, did an 800-point swing. Now, things didn't start that way. They started okay. They were fine. And then, right around 2 p.m. Eastern time, the bottom fell out of the stock market. If we have that, and I think we do, we could take a look. That is when President Biden asked Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu for an immediate ceasefire in the war with Gaza, along with more worries that Iran could soon strike back against Israel, sending stocks down and the so-called fear index higher. Let's take a closer look at all of this. All right, as we said, the Dow, right, this is 2 p.m. This is an intraday chart, okay? So write that line, a beautiful line that I just made. That's 2 p.m. Here's the Dow doing okay. Then we saw it turn down. The price of crude oil turning up. Literally, one went down, one went up. Worst day for the Dow since March of last year. All that as oil prices rose. In fact, oil trading overseas, known as Brent crude, hitting 90 bucks a barrel for the first time this year. And as the world worries more about war, you can imagine some of the defense stocks surge. This is Northrop Grumman in orange, Lockheed Martin in blue. Again, intraday chart. There's 2 p.m. Boom. Took off rising about 1.5%. And what about the VIX, the volatility index, known as the fear gauge? It popped 14%, again, right around intraday, 2 p.m. Eastern time. And with the talk of Ukraine potentially joining NATO, which, by the way, Vladimir Putin has called his, quote, red line, and reports of Iran being ready to strike back against Israel or others in the region, many of you investors out there have many reasons to be more nervous right now. Let's be clear. It is a very tense time. All right, what might happen tomorrow? We'll get a quick check on futures. Again, very thinly traded. I don't put a whole lot into the futures. Do want to show them to you, though. They are all in the green, but very, very fractionally so. So, with major geopolitical uncertainty happening, has the market been pricing out these risks during the recent bull run? And what might happen with Iran and the price of oil and everything else? Well, that's how we're going to lead off the show tonight. Joining us once again is RBC Capital Markets, Halima Croft, and Victoria Green of G-Squared Private Wealth. Halima, first to you. And if our viewers missed it, you were with us two nights ago on Tuesday. And here's what you had to say about what might happen if Israel strikes Iranian oil.
I think that is the most important question, is how far is Israel willing to push Iran, to push the Hezbollah issue, to basically address their security concerns?
I don't think.
All right. So, Halima, we've got CIA, I guess, warning about potential strikes against Israel. You wonder if Iran could strike against Iraq to spike the price of oil, just to kind of spite the West. Are we beginning to see the start of something bigger here? And if so, what might that be?
I mean, Brian, we are bracing for serious Iranian retaliation. I mean, we have seen Iran respond in the past to attacks on key personnel, like the killing of Qasem Soleimani in 2020 by attacking bases housing U.S. troops in places like Iraq. But that was a very telegraphed response. almost de-escalatory. What we're hearing from Washington is they are bracing for something more serious. The Iranian supreme leader apparently wants to reestablish deterrence to ensure that there are no future attacks on key personnel, like we saw with the embassy attack this week. But the question is, can he thread the needle in a way that does not lead to a wider war? And the Israelis have come out and said, if there is an attack on Israeli soil, there will be a serious response from Israel, leading to fears that you could see a serious escalatory tit-for-tat cycle that leads to a wider war in the region.
Yeah, let's talk about oil, by the way, because you're a commodity specialist, some of the best in the world. And Halima, we have the Iron Dome over Israel. So you wonder if Iran tried to strike directly into Israel, if that would have any effect at all. But if you're Iran and you're looking to punish, quote, the West, right, even the U.S., which has sold arms and given arms and money and goods to Israel, why not just attack Iraqi oil infrastructure? They're kind of your enemy anyway. One of the world's biggest producers. You could attack some of that infrastructure, which will take a long time to rebuild, spike the price of oil, and kind of do an economic strike on the West.
Well, Brian, I think actually we saw earlier, you know, in the last couple of weeks, we have seen attacks on, for example, the Israeli Red Sea base Eilat. So I think there is a potential that we could see something more serious with a direct Israeli target. Embassies, for example, are having stepped up security presence because of a fear of a proportional Iranian response. But when it comes to oil, I think the playbook that we should potentially pay closer attention to is what we saw in 2019 when the Iranians attacked tankers in the Straits of Hormuz, the most critical waterway for oil. And anything that resembles what we saw in 2019 when we just had a couple of tankers hit with mines, I think would send this price appreciably higher. So Iran does not have to do much to send this market higher. They could do some symbolic attacks on pipelines, and prices would rise significantly against this very fraught geopolitical backdrop.
And last one to you, Halima. We know that OPEC just reiterated their current plan, which involved cuts. You do wonder if this is an opportunity because they have a common enemy. Saudi Arabia and Iran always at odds as well. Is this an opportunity maybe for Riyadh to come forward and proactively say we're going to put a little more oil on the market because all this is happening when a little White House and geopolitical goodwill?
So, Brian, this is a great question. I mean, one of the things we have to remember is last year, basically this time last year, Iran and Saudi Arabia normalized relations. And that diplomatic deal seems to be yielding significant security dividends. The Houthis have not attacked any targets in Saudi Arabia. They have largely avoided Saudi tankers. And so I'm not sure this is the moment that Saudi Arabia wants to inject themselves into this conflict. Mm. Now, you said OPEC met. I do think the real question is, do we see something change potentially at the June meeting? Some barrels, you know, being propped back in a very sort of judicious way. But I think the Saudis would look for a material supply disruption before they rushed in with a significant volume of crude.
That June one is going to be a big one, by the way. On June 1st, you and I will be there. It will be in person
there.
And just a couple of months ahead of this election thing I keep hearing about. Victoria Green, I want to go to you from the U.S. market reaction. Listen, you're a long-term value fund manager. You're trying to find stocks to buy that will just go up in value. I know all this geopolitical stuff kind of muddles that, but I've got to imagine, Victoria, that you and your team have to have this in the back or maybe the front of your collective minds, no?
Yeah, and we've been tilting more to energy as we've seen that market recover, especially quickly here in March. You know, we've moved about 12% since mid-March up to now. And you want to be a little bit more defensive. I don't think you want to be longer duration equities. You know, some of the growth, some of the small caps. You want the quality, the dividends. And I think the industrials, the energy sectors are a really good play right now. One, if there is a disruption in oil, that could benefit a lot of U.S. producers, again, depending on what that disruption is. And then two, I think you also have them very low valuations, very strong cash flow, very strong dividends, and that should help protect investors a little bit. I think some of the stocks which you saw today, you know, some of the growthier stocks can be a little bit more exposed if we see a slowdown. But the thing is, it's what's the domino effect? Remember, stock markets don't necessarily really react all that long term to conflicts. Typically, there's a knee jerk, same as with the crude markets. But the stock markets over time, war and conflict has not been a huge downdraft to the U.S. markets, especially when it's a more regionalized Middle Eastern conflict. You know, you can go back to the 80s and 90s and how how markets were performing during different periods and invasions then. So for me, I just always like to remind the world feels terrible. It feels very unsafe right now. But the U.S. markets tend to overlook a lot of war and conflict and see it as more of a short-term disruption, but not necessarily a long-term drag.
Yeah, well said and completely accurate. But I would add this little bit of a variable, Victoria, as you're aware. Also today in the afternoon, and some people have ascribed this to why the market turned down. I think it was geopolitical, but let's add this into the mix. You had one of the Fed governors, Neel Kashkari, come out and say, oh, by the way, there may not be any rate cuts this year. I think we heard it again. If this is a market that is in some ways reliant on the Fed cutting rates one, two, three, whatever times this year, and you've got the price of oil back up to the mid-80s to early 90s, gas probably going to $5, $4 nationwide in some places, that affects the inflation story, does it not? And thus impacts what the Federal Reserve may do. And if we need rate cuts to go up and we get none, then what?
That can be tough. And again, I think that's small, that's long duration assets, the growthy assets, they get hit harder. But I will remind you, he is a non-voting member this year. We had a ton of Fed speak this afternoon, I think five or six governors. Most of them, I think Messer came out a little bit more dovish. A lot of them would be patient. I think that's going to be my new bingo card. It's not data dependent, it's be patient. But yes, I think there's a huge risk of sticky inflation here because oil prices, energy prices have been so deflationary and so nice at helping bring out CPI and PCE. And then suddenly we're going to have this uptick and it's going to hurt. It's happening right before the summer driving season. We honestly don't have a lot of stockpiles. We always see draws in March. That's a very historic time period where we see stockpile draws. But if you look at stockpiles of gasoline, you look at what's going on the East Coast stockpiles of gasoline, as well as you look at, you know, how we're going to ramp up. SPR had to cancel its bid because prices got too high. So you don't have a lot of SPR to rely on. So yeah, we are a little vulnerable to energy stocks, but we do have a lot of amazing U.S. producers, E&P companies, as well as the large integrateds that have some great finds. You know, you've got Guyana, you've got South America. I do feel like we are better insulated from Middle East oil disruption than we were in the 70s and 80s.
100% over 13 million barrels. So, and now they're predicting a stronger hurricane season. Gotten lucky the last 2 years. Let's hope that forecast is wrong.
Like long
the last,
energy.
Yep, like
gotta
the last
be
couple
long.
Have been. There you go. Victoria Green, Halima Croft, scary time. Glad you're here. Thank you very much. All right, you know the macro numbers, folks. Here's a quick check on inside your market. Your stud of the day was ConAgra. You got two food companies here. And the big decliner, Lamb Weston. That is the biggest French fry producer in America. It has a software glitch which affected orders. Earnings weren't good. Lamb Weston down 19%. All right, on deck. When Dan Ives makes a call, investors listen. And he is just out with a big one on tech. He is here with it next. Plus, is the so-called EV revolution sputtering out already? The huge move one of the big three just made that is rocking the auto world.
At the UPS store, we know things can get busy this upcoming holiday. You can count on us to be open and ready to help with any packing and shipping or anything else you might need.
Is there anything you can't do?
Actually, I don't have a good singing voice. The UPS... Nope. But our certified packing experts can pack and ship just about anything.
At least that's good.
The UPS store. Be unstoppable. Most locations are independently owned. Product, services, pricing, and hours of operation may vary. See center for details. Come in today to get your holiday goodies there on time.
You like to watch new stuff, right? Well, go to Hulu and see what's new, because Hulu has new stuff all the time. Like Vanderpump Villa, the new docudrama starring Lisa Vanderpump, where first-class luxury meets world-class drama. A new season of The Kardashians, starring The Kardashians, of course. And Grand Cayman, Secrets in Paradise, the sizzling new reality show set in the tropical Caribbean. It's all new, and it's streaming now on Hulu.
All right, let's get to tomorrow's news tonight. Some of the headlines and stories you'll be talking about tomorrow morning, Wall Street style. First up, Larry Fink faces a proxy challenge to his dual role as chair and CEO of BlackRock. An investor from the UK wants more board oversight over the $10 trillion money manager's approach to sustainable investing. So far, shares of BlackRock not moving on that news. Meantime, top tech analyst Dan Ives out with a new note. Despite the tech sector taking a hit today with everything else, by the way, Dan Ives expects a strong result for the group in this upcoming earnings season. The numbers should be rolling out here over the next couple of weeks. And the aforementioned Dan Ives joining us now managing director at Wedbush. Why are you optimistic about tech as a whole for earnings, Dan?
I think it's going to be one for the ages in terms of digital advertising. All of our survey work, much stronger than expected. The AI revolution is now going from semis to software. So you're going to now start to see the next part of this AI revolution with a better spending environment. And Brian, I think this is going to be the catalyst that gets tech stocks ultimately up another 15% rest of the year. It starts with this earnings season.
Anybody in particular you're looking at most closely?
I think front and center is going to be Microsoft. I think in terms of what we're seeing out of Redmond on cloud, of course you got Godfather of AI, Nadella. You know,
I thought the godfather of AI was Jensen Huang of NVIDIA.
Well, the godfather's
the Jensen. Consigliere.
But if you look what's really happening now, in front and center is going to be Microsoft on the cloud story. And then if you look at digital advertising, Meta, I believe the one to really pinpoint is Google. I mean, we think Google here could be ultimately $30, $40 upside on digital advertising, as well as what we're seeing on the cloud side.
It won't be this quarter, because obviously it was just sort of not really been announced, reported on yesterday. I think you saw with Google and Alphabet that they're going to start charging potentially for the use of AI in this. That would be the biggest change to Google's business model, basically, since they were created. That won't show up now, and we'll see if they even do it. So those numbers come in. Alphabet and Microsoft come in strong. If those two come in strong, is that kind of the all clear for a lot of the other names that you cover?
I think this is now going to start earnings going higher, growth going higher. And because that's what really needs to happen. It's not just, we could call it Fab Four, or whatever, Mag 7 minus Tesla. Now the rest of tech, you're going to start to see those robust earnings. And I believe this is really going to be the wake-up call for the naysayers in terms of what we see with tech, especially on the AI revolution, the second, third, fourth derivatives coming through with Microsoft, with Oracle, with others in software.
Well, they say that no two stocks are the same. So what's wrong with Snowflake?
Look, I think to me, it's really Palantir and MongoDB. I've used the best plays from an AI perspective on use case. Snowflake, it's really been an execution story. I mean, that's why we've been more hesitant on that name till execution improves. I continue, the best ways to play the use cases is the massive AI Palantir along with MongoDB.
And who else? Anybody else that you're worried about?
Look, I mean, I'd be worried about the shared owners. I think that's HP, that's Cisco.
What is a shared owner?
A shared donor is basically like that. You have ones that are gaining market share and losing market share. When you look at Cisco and HP and some of these legacy players, they're giving away market share. And that's why it's Microsoft, it's Oracle. That's really, from a software perspective, they're the ones that are gaining share. And when you think about this AI revolution, it's just starting. We have $1 trillion of spend over the next decade.
I'll tell you, Oracle, by the way, hell of a story, because people counted them out. They're like, oh, just a boring database company. They really pivoted and have just kicked tail. Almost said something else. Kicked butt in that time quickly. Apple, they've got big robot dreams, right? They're like the Isaac Asimov of stocks. You don't like it.
It would be a horror show. If they actually spent money on robots. Look at the failed EV initiative, Project Titan. They need to focus on AI. For Cook, his legacy is going to be AI. If they went after robots, that would be a black eye moment for Apple.
Well said. We got a big earnings season that is kicking off here in about a week or so. Dan Ives, appreciate you coming
Thanks
in.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much. All right, still ahead, the massive move that Ford just made that is rocking the auto world.
At the UPS Store, we know things can get busy this upcoming holiday. You can count on us to be open and ready to help with any packing and shipping or anything else you might need.
Is there anything you can't do?
Actually, I don't have a good singing voice. The UPS... Nope. But our certified packing experts can pack and ship just about anything.
At least that's good.
The UPS Store. Be unstoppable. Most locations are independently owned. Product, services, pricing, and hours of operation may vary. See center for details. Come in today to get your holiday goodies there on time.
All right, welcome back. A rather, dare we say, shocking headline from Detroit today. Ford is delaying production of its all-electric SUV and pickup trucks, now shifting focus toward hybrid options across its lineup by 2030. And a Ford rep told me earlier that they are, quote, allocating capital to customer demand that leads to profitable growth, giving them what they want while driving shareholder value, end quote. Electric cars, of course, outside of Tesla, have been met with pretty tepid customer demand. They're expensive to build and so far have lost billions for Ford and others. This is a big deal announcement from Ford. Now, of course, got to wait and see if GM follows Ford on this one. But we know that car buyers, as we have been talking about now since the show launched, have been lapping up hybrids. Right now, Toyota, it's got a pretty big lead there, accounting for just over half the U.S. market share last quarter. And unlike others, Toyota pulled a Fleetwood Mac. They went their own way, saying hybrids would win over purely electric cars. Toyota also says that hybrids are just as environmentally friendly as EVs because they don't require as much mineral mining and infrastructure to build out on the electricity side. Toyota stock has been rewarded, more than doubling in the past 10 years. So could Ford's move and Toyota's hybrid success signal a shift for Detroit's overall EV revolution and evolution? Joining us now is celebrity motor car owner Tom Maioli. Tom owns several dealerships, including Lexus, owned by Toyota and Ford, as well as CNBC.com reporter Mike Whalen. Mike, I want to start with you. I saw the headline this morning. I said, wow, this is, to me, tell me if I'm wrong, and I know we've been on this story for a long time, so I'm not trying to toot my own horn. This seems like a really big deal.
You know, Brian, for years, Ford's been touting these two products, the next-gen pickup and this three-row SUV, as like nothing that you've ever seen before. And now we're just not going to see it for at least another 3 to 5 years for the SUV. And they were describing it as the bullet train, and it just kind of went away. And just to be clear, I mean, we're going to see a growth in EV just by the sheer number of products in the industry, but hybrids are becoming more in vogue. But the biggest thing is the EV euphoria, which we've written about, it's dead. The whole hype about this is going to be a smooth transition. It is going to be quick. Consumers are just going to adopt all these vehicles, and automakers are just going to look the other way while they're losing billions of dollars. A quarter is gone. It's just gone. And yes, we are seeing a massive swing for most automakers right now away from that EV euphoria and back to reality.
It's a very good lesson when you hear politicians use words like, well, it's irreversible or it's irrefutable. Folks, when you hear those words with regard to anything, when you hear the words never or ever, that's when you need to start asking questions and paying attention. Tom, people say that I'm some sort of EV hater. Not true. I bought one. I'm getting a plug-in hybrid actually next week. But because I've owned them, because I've driven so many, and I talk to dealers like you, and by the way, many, many others across America, it's not my opinion. You see it. People come in, they ask questions, and then they either buy an EV or they try to return it for a hybrid. Do they not?
Listen, it's a disaster. I mean, I call it the biggest political blunder since Vietnam. I've been calling for an EV crash. We're here. We're seeing it. And listen, Farley's doing the right thing. Jim is a friend. You know, he was with Toyota. I'm a Lexus Toyota dealer, and I know Jim very well. He's a brilliant operator. He knows what he's doing, and he's got to protect shareholder value. You know, the value is dropping. The EVs they're producing them. They can't sell them. Hybrids are selling 10 to 1 on the floor. Consumers are coming in. And the reality of it is it makes sense. They don't need chargers. There's no infrastructure issues. There's no range anxiety. And they're more cost effective to operate. And I have to tell you, when we talk about mining minerals, which are all coming from the Ukraine and Russia, you know, you could build 25 hybrids with the minerals that it takes to build one EV. This is a brilliant move by Farley, and it's a brilliant move by Ford. And you know what? Toyota called it a long time ago, and they went their own separate way, and they knew what they were doing. You know, Toyota has always been on the forefront. And I think this is where the industry is going. EVs will grow. They'll be a part of the market. They're never taking it over.
Yeah, I mean, the minerals, they come from a lot of places. Australia, Chile as well. Malaysia, they're mine. China, they control the thing. Your point, though, Tom, is pretty well taken. Mike, I've never met Jim Farley. I sent out a tweet today. I said, sort of congrats to him, because I think he's got to, A, protect his dealers, B, protect his customers, C, protect his investors, and D, protect his jobs. And we spent the day. We didn't do a 10-minute drop-in with the UAW, as you know. I did a whole day there with my producers. I was there for 12 to 15 hours. I'm just going to tell you, that despite what they may say in public, because they have to, many of the UAW rank and file that I talked to were worried. They were skeptical. They saw the sales weren't working, and they said, I hope I have a damn job in a year, because they all felt it was overly political and had nothing to do with what the customer actually wanted. I'm not blanket. People love Teslas. I get it. Some people love EVs. Fine. But the UAW is worried. I'm just going to tell you, I talked to a lot of them.
Yep. Yeah, Brian, I mean, they've been They've been looking into this for years now. I mean, they did a white paper back two contracts ago when they were looking at losing thousands upon thousands of jobs due to EVs. And also, let's be clear, Ford said that they're going to postpone or delay, cancel $12 billion in planned EV investment. So we're not there yet. We're just going to probably see more of these announcements keep coming. So this is just kind of the beginning of when we're seeing people come back to reality and decide, you know what, consumers aren't going to adopt EV as fast as possible. We need to shift and tack, and we need to do this to make money.
Yeah, and listen, the idea people can get into the environmental debate, Toyota, to your point, Tom, will argue hybrids are just as good because you don't need the mineral build out. They're not as tough on tires because the weight of EVs. Right. We can lurch into that debate, which is a totally separate debate. Right. But also talk to our viewers out there again. People say, well, the EVs are much cheaper to operate, which, again, I've owned one. They are in certain ways. But when you factor in the resale value drop, I'm seeing Ford F-150 Lightnings with 3,000 miles on them for sale for $47,000. And they were $95,000 new a year ago.
50% of the value, the retail value. There's no residual value on these EVs. And the reality of it is that, you know, you got to adopt to consumer demand. And listen, if Apple builds iPads and iPhones, if they're not selling iPads, they're going to stop building them. And that's what's going on in the industry. It's happening across the board. This is not just Ford. You're going to see announcements one after the other, like dominoes. Everybody's cutting back on EV production because they can't sell them. And if you can't sell them, you're hurting the dealers. You're putting resources towards a technology that is not readily adaptable in an environment that we live in today. And they're going to put their money for their shareholders in places where they're going to make profits. And that's what Farley's doing. It's a brilliant move on his part. And you're going to see many other manufacturers follow.
Well, I think Jim Farley and co. gave sort of a political opening for others. By the way, if BYD of China comes in, let them and VinFast battle it out for the $20,000 electric car. Save the UAW jobs. Tom, Mike, thank you both very much. Right, coming up, a lowbrow money grab in New York that could be soon coming to a big city near you. Plus, can you guess? Here's a quiz. How many cities in America now have an average home sale price of more than $1 million? You have any ideas? Hit me up at the commercial break at Sully CNBC. The mind-blowing answer coming up. That actually happens in my head. All right, time for your daily RBI. And today, let's get random but interesting on real estate, because we just came across a stat that kind of blew our collective mind. You know that home prices in America just keep going up. But just how much they've gone up shocked even us, because earlier, like 2 minutes ago, we asked you to send us your answer to this sort of riddle. How many cities in America have an average home price of more than $1 million. Now, I just got a text from somebody who clearly cheated. My next guest, Melissa, said 5, and somebody on Twitter said 11. Well, Zillow reports that there are now 550 cities and towns in America where the average home price is in the 7-figure club. Yes, 550, where homes average more than $1 million. And don't come at me with math averages. Yeah, there's one $10 million home, whatever. That number is up 59 cities from last year, 12%, as home prices just keep rising. As expected, California has the most million-dollar cities with 210, which is more than the next 5 states combined. New York, think about all the little towns and cities in Westchester and Long Island, has 66 cities with million-dollar average price homes, followed by New Jersey, Florida, and Massachusetts. Oh, by the way, there were some losers as well. Zillow notes that 3 states, Florida, Texas, and Delaware, actually lost some million-dollar hometowns because prices came down, probably because they popped during COVID as people fled lockdowns. Either way, $1 million each for millions of homes. And if you're wondering what that looks like on paper, Here you go. According to MortgageCalculator.org, you buy an exactly $1 million home. Somehow you come up with a $200,000 down payment. Thanks, Mom and Dad or Grandpa. Good luck with that. With $12,000 per year in property tax, which is probably low, and $3,000 a year in homeowners insurance, a 7% mortgage will run you $6,572 per month or about $79,000 per year. Oh, and over the life of the loan, you will pay $1.1 million in interest alone, $360,000 in property taxes, and $90,000 in home insurance. Good luck, America. Random, but expensive. Well, if you live in New York City or any other city in big debt for that matter, pay attention. Because in June, New York City is planning to enact its first congestion pricing plan. Under the new rules, drivers will be charged $15 to enter the Central Business District of Manhattan. That is anything below 60th Street. So if you drive from 61st to 60th, one block, you get a $15 charge. It will also effectively create a first ever toll of sorts for drivers coming across bridges and tunnels from Queens and Brooklyn. Because once they hit Manhattan, the congestion pricing hits their easy pass or bills their license plate. Right now, it's free. It's the same state. Now, if you don't live around here, know that cars already have to pay up to $15 to drive in from New Jersey, which means if you add up, let's say you drive on the New Jersey Turnpike, you get that toll, the Holland Tunnel toll, the congestion fee, and the average price of parking. You could be paying $80 to $100 just to drive into Manhattan. And maybe that's the point. Don't do it. Supporters of the plan say congestion pricing is needed because Manhattan is just too crowded and that the money will be used to fund New York City public transit. But opponents like New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy say the move unfairly targets commuters. Governor Murphy saying in a statement, quote, "The MTA's actions are further proof that they are determined to violate the law in order to balance their budget on the backs of New Jersey commuters." I resemble that remark, Governor. New Jersey is challenging the congestion pricing in court. This kind of pricing plan, it already exists in some global cities like London, Singapore, and others. But could this be coming to Chicago or LA or San Francisco next? In the meantime, is it a move that could save money for New Yorkers? By the way, Governor Kathy Hochul announcing the city will not be making New York City marathon goers pay for lost toll revenue when the big race uses the Verrazano Narrows Bridge in November after the MTA had gone to a head with the marathon organizers suggesting, get this, this is a real story. This is not a fake story, that the marathoners have to pay $750,000 to make up for the lost tolls because they got to close the bridge for a day so people can celebrate the biggest marathon in the United States. Luckily, that looks like it's getting turned back on. All right, joining us now is former top aide to Governor Andrew Cuomo, Melissa DeRosa, who, by the way, I'm told was involved in the initial negotiation for this.
I was. Well,
what? Why? I mean, I can get it. Manhattan is a disaster. Too many cars. I see it. But should people from Queens have to pay to drive across the Queensboro Bridge?
You know, look, I absolutely was both directly involved in congestion pricing getting passed in 2019, and I was personally a proponent of it within our administration. Here's what I will say. The world today in 2024 is a lot different than the world was in 2019 when we passed congestion pricing. And I think that the problem that we have right now is that our elected officials, and you see it across the board, Brian, but you see it especially, you know, in the marathon case you were just talking about now with congestion pricing, there is a disconnect between the elected officials and the constituents they serve. And right now, people don't have to come to New York anymore. They don't have to, right? Work from home has changed all of that. And so if you don't want to drive into New York, if you don't want to pay $100 for parking, for congestion pricing, for the toll fees, you can choose to stay home.
That's bad. Listen, I forget about driving. I get what they're trying to do. One of my friends actually was, as you know who he is, I won't name him on the air, was involved. And this was kind of almost his, partly his baby. And we've had a lot of discussions about this. I was in Manhattan last night, pouring rain. It was only me, Noah, and a bunch of pairs of animals that were running around last night. But the city felt empty. And to your point about you don't have to come, that's scary. And I feel like the politicians are getting desperate to raise money from an increasingly desperate population.
Well, and the other thing is, look, they should be enforcing the current rules that are in place. The goal of congestion pricing is to raise $1 billion a year in revenue for the MTA. Right now, the MTA is losing $700 million a year from fare beating, Brian. So how about we stop the people that are jumping over the turnstile, stop selectively enforcing who's going to pay to get on and off the subway, and make up the difference there? So there are other ways that you can do it. And what kills me is that the politicians are not seeing the potential consequences of their actions. This is how lemmings go off cliffs. We are in a very fragile moment in New York right now. 800,000 people have left since COVID. By the way, you're not just seeing this in New York. You're seeing this in California. You're seeing this in Illinois. Other left-leaning blue states were bleeding population to places like Florida, Texas, Georgia. And the problem is that you're seeing this disconnect with elected officials who are not getting the message and understanding that if we don't start to make choices that are smart to be able to
bring people. Aren't they just kind of doubling down, though, Melissa? Chicago,
no, they absolutely
Chicago just tried to have this fake mansion tax, which is actually just a real estate transfer tax, which would have probably soared rents on people that can't afford it. Luckily, it didn't pass. But it's like this desperation for money.
Well, and you know what? Like every other homeowner in America, make some tough choices, make some cuts, figure out how to make up money in other places. But we are not, we have to have an attitude adjustment. Urban centers in this country, particularly in blue high tax states, need a reality check and an attitude adjustment, because every day we're losing more population to warm weather climates with less regulation and lower taxes. And that's only going to get worse with things like congestion pricing.
Or the marathon, which, by the way, we got to let you go. I had an idea for that, how to fix that.
Tell me.
So you just stuff an easy pass in your socks. So when you're running, they can get you with the toll. They get the money. You get to run.
I don't know why you're not running the MTA. Perfect.
I know why I'm not running the New York Marathon. I can name 26.2 miles of reason why I'm not running the marathon. Melissa DeRosa, great stuff. Thank you very much.
Thank you. All right.
Let's get now to our quicker than the ticker. All the best of the rest of the headlines.
Let's put 60 seconds on the clock. Disney CEO Bob Iger sounding off on succession plans after Nelson Peltz's boardroom battle. Here's what Iger told David Faber.
Our shareholders are interested and care very much about succession. It is the board's number one priority. They've been spending a significant amount of time on that. They met seven times last year. They intend to meet even more this year. They're confident they will choose the right person at the right time.
An Easter Sunday heist in Los Angeles. The FBI and LA Police Department announcing they're investigating a heist of as much as $30 million from a money storage facility. It could be the largest cash robbery in the city's history. The White House directing NASA to create Coordinated Lunar Time, or LTC, on the moon by the end of 2026. That, according to Reuters, is to help set a benchmark for spacecrafts and satellites. The new Pink Panther. Phillips Auction House set to sell a 6.2-carat vivid pink diamond ring that could go up to $15 million. All right, coming up here on Last Call, the influenza outbreak that could spike the price of milk and beef at the grocery store. More on that next.
Last thing I want to talk about is the pandemic. I just want to throw that out there. But there are some troubling developments around a recent outbreak of bird flu. Over the last 2 years, by the way, the bird flu has led to the death of 80 million birds. Okay. But now it's starting to spread to cows. And the U.S. Department of Agriculture reporting it's hit more than a dozen dairy herds in states like Texas, Kansas, New Mexico, Michigan, and Idaho. And at least one person, a human, in Texas has been diagnosed with bird flu after having contact with dairy cows. The Wall Street Journal reports that it's now spooking cattle farmers across the U.S., which means there could be a follow-through in the price of beef and milk and things like eggs at the grocery store. Let's talk more about it. Joining us is the reporter behind that journal piece, and that is Patrick Thomas. Patrick, I mean, we don't want to talk about pandemics for like the next 100 years. I get it. But this seems like a big deal.
Yeah, it's a big deal. There's still a lot we don't quite know about what the virus is going to do in cattle. And, you know, obviously the person who caught it so far, the symptoms have been mild in people. In dairy cattle, it's also been pretty mild. It's curbed milk production in the cows that have gotten it. They're typically older dairy cows. But so far, this is one of the first cases of it spreading to another area of U.S. agriculture. We've seen the bird flu, which has been around for 2 years, led to the death of more than 80 million birds, been a big deal. We've seen it spread to some other mammals, but this is one of the first times we've seen it impact another area of U.S. agriculture. But there's still a lot we don't know, including how this will affect milk supplies and of course, the workers.
And avian flu, bird flu, is a real worry. It's very rare in humans. Luckily, we talked about one human being, but this is a serious and often deadly condition.
Well, it's deadly for the birds. In humans, we've only had two confirmed cases in the U.S. and so far, the CDC has told us that it is low risk to humans, and it is something that has been mild symptoms. So far, at least what we're getting from the CDC, that there's not cause for alarm. This has been something that is more contagious if you're working directly with the animals or in close contact with their environments. But so far for people, it's not quite the same for chickens and turkeys, where it has near 100% mortality for the birds. And even the dairy cattle have recovered so far, and in some cases are at least able to keep producing milk. So this has just happened in the last 2 weeks. We're still getting information from the USDA and the CDC. They're still trying to also confirm if this is spreading from cow to cow. That is another big point for the industry in trying to figure out how exactly is this spreading amongst the dairy herds.
And to your point about birth, let's hope this is the last that we hear of this, and this is the last that you have to write about this. I think we can all agree on that, because we just don't have the collective appetite or tolerance for any more pandemics. Patrick Thomas, a piece everybody should read. Patrick, thank you very much. Do appreciate it. All right, coming up, a much lighter story. Well, actually, that's not light at all. A once-in-a-generation event for home rentals, courtesy of half of America going dark in the middle of the day. That's right, a bonus TNT for you. Some eye-popping earnings just crossing just now from Samsung in South Korea. Samsung posted a 931% jump in operating profit. Not a misprint, 931% jump. The big driver was a huge recovery in sales and prices for its memory chips. It does not trade here. All right, are you planning to get away and book an Airbnb for the solar eclipse on Monday? Well, good luck, because many short-term rentals are already booked up. Don't believe me? Take a look at this graphic from AirDNA, which tracks short-term rental data. See all those, the orange dots there stretching from Texas all the way through Buffalo and up into Maine? Well, those are all the cities and towns where short-term rentals are extremely booked. That also happens to be the path where people can see the total solar eclipse. Let's talk more about this and bring in AirDNA chief economist Jamie Lane. Jamie, this is fascinating. I mean, people are literally driving to places in the middle of Kentucky and Buffalo, where they can see the eclipse?
Yeah, we're seeing people travel from all across the country. For cities that are in the path, we see on the night before the eclipse, they're 92% occupied on average, and many cities along the path are fully booked. We're seeing really strong demand in Austin, Dallas, Broken Bow, Oklahoma, Indianapolis, Cleveland, Fredericksburg, Texas, Hill Country, Hot Springs, Arkansas. Like, it's very strong demand all along the path.
Yeah, amazing. And looking at your data, is that it's nearly 100% occupancy in many of these places. What was the occupancy rate in those places prior to the eclipse?
Yeah, so on the same day, like the week prior, week after, we're seeing occupancy levels of about 30 or 40%. April's typically not a high season for demand in many of these areas. So this really is a boom for demand in what's typically a low demand period.
Yeah, it really is. And are people, whenever there's a big event in many towns, right, a graduation or an F1 race, people leave, right? If an F1 race came to Princeton, I'd probably go away and rent my house out for a lot of money. But I guess we're not seeing that. People aren't vacating their homes. So I've got to imagine the homes that are available, the prices are going up, up, up.
Yes and no. like you said, we typically see a large increase in supply around special events like F1, like the Super Bowl. And we're really not seeing that. We're seeing actually a slight decline of existing hosts that are actually taking their unit off for that night and saying, you know what, I've got a second home. The eclipse comes once in a blue moon. Like, I want to stay and use that. That's pushing occupancies to the record levels that we see. And rates, while up, aren't as up as maybe as much as you'd think. We're seeing rates only up about 18% on average when you look at all the cities in the path.
Truly remarkable. Very unique data. It's a cool event. I never would have thought that people would travel, maybe in some cases long distance, to see it. And I think the next one, correct me, world, internet, if I'm wrong, is like 2044. So it's like another 20 years or something. Jamie Lane, really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Very special, back in time. 54 years ago today, that man and that woman got married. That man in the lemon yellow shirt with the iPhone oddly stuffed into his pen pocket, that's my dad, that's Tom. That beautiful lady on the left, that's my mom, Charmaine. 54 years ago, they got married, and I wanna say thanks, I love you guys, they're still cooking. And thanks for getting married, because otherwise I probably wouldn't be here. And then you'd have a different host on this show and could be totally different. Love you, Mom and Dad. Happy 54th anniversary. Thanks for watching. Shark Tank is next.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. FedEx Ground service is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.